Meet Reed L. Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try and fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
We have a big treat today. We have an interview with David Rare. This guy rocks. He is a CEO. He has 25 years of experience in governance, federal policy, management, fundraising. He has a PhD in economics. He is often on CNN, Fox, NPR, MSNBC, and foreign networks such as Canal, the largest French broadcaster. He's generally been recognized as one of the top lobbyists, pro-business lobbyists in the United States for more than 10 years. And he was a CEO of the National Association of Broadcasters. You've all heard of them. And was in charge of the transition to digital TV, which they pulled off without a hitch. Mr. Rare is intimately familiar with government, how it works, and the structural change we need to make at the big level in government if this country is to survive and prosper again, and also at the individual level. And that's what this interview is going to be about today. And the new company that he is CEO of, and I'm going to let him tell you about it, is incredible. And their solution to government waste, government overspending, government largesse, and government growth through software applications which make government truly transparent. You know, there's lots of lip service about transparency, but let's face it. Transparent? Yeah, a brick wall is about as transparent as a federal government. I'm going to start off the show, though, with a little background for you, because it all ties in to the interview with Dave and what we can do about this. Let me give you some facts here. You're just, I promised you this last show, and I'm going to stick with my promise. You know, it was America that showed the world how to mass produce everything from automobiles to televisions to airplanes to widgets. It was that manufacturing base which crushed Nazi Germany and Japan in World War II, and which catapulted us to by far the largest economy and most prosperous economy, and the freest nation in the world. But, you know, that is slipping away. And with it is slipping away our freedoms, our economy, our prosperity, and our children's future. You know, our dauntless president, when he was on the campaign trail in 2008, I mean, you know, when the lips move, one should be suspect. But you're going to love this quote. You're just going to love it. I quote, "The problem is that the way Bush has done it over the last 8 years is to take out a credit card from the Bank of China in the name of our children, driving up the national debt from $5 trillion for the first 42 presidents. Number 43 added $4 trillion by his lonesome. So now we have $9 trillion of debt that we are going to have to pay back. $30,000 for every man, woman, and child. That's irresponsible. It's unpatriotic." Unquote. Those are the words of Barack Obama on the campaign trail in 2008. Well, guess what? CBS News reported, because the Treasury Department reported, that the national debt has now increased almost exactly, in fact a little bit more, than $4 trillion on President Obama's watch. I think he's been on the job for about 2.5 years. Let's see. It's unpatriotic for Bush to increase the debt by $4 trillion over 8 years, which, by the way, I agree with. So, Mr. Obama, Barack, but what does that mean about you? $4 trillion in 2.5 years? Holy smokes. How would you describe yourself, sir? Yes. He's also had the most rapid regulatory increase in the entire history of the United States. Businesses now estimate that it's $1.75 trillion a year. Do you realize that's like 40% of our entire U.S. budget? just to comply with all the new regs that are coming out. More than 4,000 of them over the last year, 609 in July, all by itself. Thank you, Mr. Obama. Thank you, Cass Sunstein, regulatory czar. I mean, the paradox of all this, the hypocrisy of all this, and yes, to use Mr. Obama's own words, the unpatriotic nature of all this absolutely makes my eyes cross. I don't know what it does to yours, but it makes mine cross. I'm going to give you some examples of some unpatriotic spending via directly Mr. Obama, after giving that 2008 speech, through his stimulus plan and other little gimmies and gotchas and, you know, I think I'll take care of my friends and I think I'll buy some votes and you know how all that deal works. Well, how about this? $50,000 was given to Atlanta, Georgia centers for the puppetry arts. Oh, okay, great. That's terrific. It created 1.9 jobs. Perhaps one retained puppeteer was missing a digit? What do you think? And, then he spent $10,890,000 and change. I'm sorry, $10 billion. Excuse me. You know, you get confused with these numbers, these unpatriotic numbers. $10,890,060,866 on important agricultural programs, such as the catfish producers got $9 million to compensate them for their losses for increased feed for their catfish. Catfish. Yummy. Let's subsidize them. And, of course, we all know about the ethanol boondoggle. All the environmentalists clamored for ethanol like 8 or 9 years ago. Now it's like a $25 billion subsidy that we're paying. It's increasing our food costs because all the corn's going into ethanol. And the same environmentalists who pushed it, including Mr. Obama, except he's not against it right now. The same environmentalists who pushed it are now saying, God, this was a mistake. We need to undo this. Well, thanks, guys. Kind of like your global warming theories, maybe? Jeez. Oh, yeah, by the way, Algood Peanut Butter, you know, a company that makes peanut butter, they got $5 million from the stimulus bill. Yep, that's great. And then the Department of Agriculture started subsidizing some of the school lunches in New York that were serving peanut butter sandwiches. Now think about that round circle, that unpatriotic round circle. You subsidize the farmers for making the peanut butter. Then you subsidize the schools that buy the costly peanut butter, because of the subsidies, for their students. And you get to pay for it. We're all big winners in this deal, don't you think? It's very patriotic. Oh, but you're going to love this one. How about this? So, you know, there's 2 million foreclosures in California. I think everybody knows California, except for just a few tiny little districts and centers here and there, mostly where Nancy Pelosi has funneled a bunch of federal dollars to get votes, of course. It has maybe the worst real estate market in the United States overall. It's certainly up there amongst the top three or four. So, 1 in 5 foreclosures in the country takes place in California. Do you know what Mr. Obama's solution is? It's very patriotic. Build more houses! That's what we need. Let's see. Our supply is going up, so we need to increase our supply. Wow. You know, I've been in real estate for 40 years. That's such a novel concept, I'm going to have to sit down and ponder it. Yeah. You got unsold houses. Build more unsold houses. That ought to really, really, really help. So, there's $325,877,114 allocated to build 3,550 units of affordable housing in California. Gee, with 2 million, give or take, vacant homes in the state, you really think we need to be building housing? For $325 million of our money when we're broke? Oh, come on. And you'll love this. This is terrific. Yeah, You know, Mr. Obama's buddies, the unions, you know, they put in $400 billion to his reelection campaign. He basically kisses their butt every time he can. He talks on one hand out of one side of his mouth about, oh, the last thing I worry about before I go to bed at night is jobs. And then he appoints people to the NRLB, the National Labor Relations Board, who are absolutely pro-union, and they shut down 1,000 new jobs in South Carolina that Boeing wants to produce in a $1 billion plant that company has already built. Then they support, along with Mr. Obama, GE entering into a joint venture. This just came out last week. A joint venture with China's largest airplane manufacturer that will compete against Boeing, not to mention give the Chinese military access to all our confidential GE avionics that makes our Air Force superior. I mean, this is the glittering quarter in the right hand, and the left hand's doing exactly the opposite, and intentionally. Is this patriotic or is this unpatriotic? Is it a mistake or is it intentional? I don't know. Let's think about this. By the way, that the Service Employees International Union, you know, SEIU, Workers of the World Unite, Andy Stern, they got millions and millions and millions out of the stimulus, but $2 million specifically was given them for their. You know, I'm laughing just looking at this stuff. It's not funny. The Union League Job Security Fund. Okay. Well, those funds are to train workers, union workers, that are laid off on the job so they can get new jobs. But, you know, if you can't train them and they can't get new jobs, guess what happens? They get extra unemployment benefits. Doesn't that make you happy? You folks who are unfortunately unemployed listening to this show, doesn't that make you happy that your union counterparts are getting twice the money you are or for a much longer period of time using your tax money to do so? I bet you're just thrilled. I bet you think it's very patriotic. Very patriotic. And all this is exacerbated by a regulatory onslaught with regulations drafted by Mr. Sunstein and promulgated by a number of agencies, but particularly the EPA, who is absolutely run and controlled by radical environmentalists appointed by the Obama administration. They have shut down the energy policy such that it was in this country. They are forcing us to export dollars, in other words, equalize with less fortunate countries to buy their oil rather than producing our own. And you'll love this. Your electrical rates are about to go up. Do you remember Mr. Obama on the campaign trail? Electricity rates will necessarily skyrocket. That's a direct quote from the guy who now sits in the Oval Office, thanks to the votes of many Americans, and I bet even some of you. You can think about that every time you turn on your light switch or fill your tank of gas. And the EPA is not above lying about their regulations, which they're inserting against the wishes and behind the backs of Congress at Obama's bidding. No. In fact, when they were questioned by Congress over this shutting down emissions at coal plants, which has already forced 7 plants offline and increased the cost of power, when they were questioned about that by Congress, said, oh, don't worry, we're having this whole entire thing reviewed by FERC. Yeah, okay. Well, FERC is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. They're pretty much bipartisan. You know, they kind of have the best interests of the most energy in the most effective way at the least cost for all of us. Well, when FERC was questioned by Congress, they said, no, that's not true. They haven't asked us to look at anything. They're just off on their own doing this stuff. Here's a quote from Tony Borsello. He's a PhD and director of the National Center for Public Policy. The EPA's deception of the public is outrageous, and it exposes the agency's underlying zeal to regulate without regard to the consequences of its actions. How true. The EPA's actions may very well put the reliability of our electricity supply in jeopardy. End quote. Well, Mr. Obama, why don't you worry about that at night? That'd be patriotic. Oh, and then And then, of course, we have the polar bears. The polar bears, of course, are being used to kind of shut down exploration and energy development, you know, up north where polar bears live. Well, it seems that several scientists, very highly placed and very well respected scientists in the Interior Department, they questioned the whole thing about polar bears being succumbing to global warming and being made extinct by energy exploration. In fact, the guy's name is Charles Monnett, M-O-N-N-E-T-T. This is a very well-known guy. And his fellow biologist, Jeffrey Gleason, they're now being questioned by the Interior Department, and they've been put on administrative leave. And it's been suggested to them that their study is faulty, that polar bears really didn't drown, and polar bears really weren't killed by other polar bears, and polar bears really didn't die of old age. Polar bears were only killed by man and that dirty gray cloud of global warming. So we have information being manipulated to us on the one hand, and on the other, we have our very top guy, unfortunately, telling us that what the guy before him did in 8 years and he's done in 2.5 years is unpatriotic. Okay. But he stays awake at night thinking about jobs. Okay. Who you gonna believe? Who you gonna believe? Well, you know, this all results in the deindustrialization of America. I mean, bottom line, if you look at the big picture, if you look at the cumulative effect of all this, if you look at the jobs going overseas, the unemployment rate, the whole nine yards, we are deindustrializing. No nation has ever remained great if it doesn't make something. We are becoming consumers, not makers. We are becoming talkers, not doers. This is not a good thing. And it starts with accountability in government, which Dave Rehr is going to be talking about, and how he is going to force it on government using public opinion to put in place programs which make even the smallest government transaction transparent in a heartbeat, in a nanosecond. You're going to love it. Let me go back to this deindustrialization. Yes, well, so how would you like this? These are some little facts for you, just real quick. So the United States has lost 42,400 factories since 2001. Let me repeat that. Since 2001. That's just 10 years ago. 42,400 factories. 75% of those factories employed 500 people or more. Do the math. Mr. Obama, are you awake? Are you sleepless? Are you sleepless in Washington? Dell, one of America's largest manufacturers of computers, they're expanding their operations in China. Yep. Investing over $100 billion over the next 10 years, and they're announcing that they're closing their last large manufacturing facility in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, this November. This November. Yep. The U.S. trade deficit with China, I'm using that Dell deal as an example, will result in a loss of about 500,000 jobs just this year alone. Mr. Obama, are you asleep yet? Or are you awake? Are you pacing the carpet there in the Oval Office in front of that big desk, rubbing your forehead and going, oh my God, how can I save the jobs? How can I be patriotic? Consumption in the United States accounts for 70% of GDP. We've lost 32% of our manufacturing jobs, 32% of all manufacturing jobs, even non-factory jobs, since the year 2000. We were fourth in the world in broadband internet use in 2001. Now we're 15th. Manufacturing employment in the U.S. computer industry is lower in 2010 than it was in 1975. That's right. You hear about this, all this high-tech stuff and how wonderful it is and how great it is and all that kind of stuff. Well, them's the facts, Jack. The United States spends approximately $3.90 on Chinese goods for every $1 the Chinese spend on goods from the United States. You know, Donald Trump may have something about going over there and being a little tougher with the Chinese. But I'm sure Mr. Obama is pacing in the White House, sleepless, thinking about how to do that and be patriotic. Oh, boy. Thanks, Barack. Well, I could go on, but, you know, I think this gives you the idea. I promised you in the last show I'm going to start giving you some tips on how to protect yourself. And then we're going to segue in quickly to David Rare and a terrific interview. I mean, it's really thought-provoking. I think you're going to love it. This guy is sharper than a tack. And his heart and his head is in the right place. And he has the experience to back it. I mean, 30 years in Washington, D.C. is a lot of experience. In any event, what I want to do right now is to tell you that the first step that you can think about taking is to stock up on food. We've discussed in previous shows the fact that many commodities, including grains and corn and sugars, have gone up from 35 to 165% in the last 2 years. Now, you know, I've heard liberal commentators say, there is no inflation. Okay, well, they must be pacing with Barack at midnight. So I want you to stock up on food, okay? You don't have to. It's just a suggestion. But with food prices going up, you know, if you're buying non-perishable goods, you'll probably save money in addition to maybe protecting you and your family. Once upon a time, the food suppliers in the United States kept large stores of grain. But that's no longer the case. You know, they tried to protect against interruptions in growing cycles and droughts and all those things which befall agriculture. But now the economy has caught up with them. And basically, when they cut grain, it goes to market. They need the cash flow. And that's understandable. But that means we have little or no food buffer. You know, let's say there was a huge storm. Let's say there was a transportation disruption, a huge terrorist attack, a meltdown of the dollar, a collapse of the... I mean, who knows? Bad things can happen. This is an unstable planet. And we have an unstable government. So what you need to do to protect you and your family is to stockpile some food. You can do it over, you know, a series of weeks or months. You don't have to run right out and get it all done. And one of the experts, Lee Bellinger, in this stuff, this is his recommendations. Number one, you want to store about 1,200 calories per day for each person in your household. So, you know, 1,200 to 1,500 calories, a family of four is going to need about 180,000 calories on hand if you're going to have a month supply of food. So start buying canned foods. Canned foods contain water. Okay? They'll hydrate you. And they last a long, long time. Add in some dry goods. Okay? That will give you grains, and if they're dried fruits, that'll give you other important nutrients that you'll need. You know, stock up on lots of canned vegetables. Very important. That's vitamins and minerals. And canned fruits, too. Not just dried fruits. And canned meats. I mean, I'm not telling you I'm a big fan of canned food. I'm not. Yuck. In fact, I'm not even sure I know how to operate the electric opener here on my counter. But, nonetheless, common sense dictates canned food is your best type of storage. It's also one of your most inexpensive food items to stockpile. And you folks can rotate it out. You know, there's expiration dates on all this stuff. It's good for a year or 2 years or 3 years, whatever it is. It's right on the labels. So, you know, if you need a couple cans of ravioli for dinner one night and your food supply, you know, your emergency food bank has a couple cans of ravioli which are nearing their expiration date, buy the two cans of ravioli, use the two older cans, put the two new cans in the food bank. I mean, you really can't go wrong. And if everything turns out rosy and the birds chirp and the sun is bright and shining, And America is prosperous once again, and I think eventually we will be. I have a lot of faith in America, Americans, and the American spirit, and in the principles upon which this country was founded. But if that day happens far sooner than many of us believe is possible, unfortunately, with the hole we're in, then great. You know, you got enough food to pretty much eat for the next couple of years, and you don't have to buy anything. Either way, you can't lose, and you owe it to your family to do so.
Listeners, I have a treat for you today. We have David K. Rehr, that's R-E-H-R, with us. And David has a long and distinguished career. He also likes cowboys, of course. That's one of the reasons I like him. And David, he has 25 years of experience in federal policy, management, and fundraising. For the last decade or more, he's been named as one of the top and most influential lobbyists, pro-business lobbyists in Washington, D.C. He actually speaks on behalf of George Washington University on political science matters. He has a doctorate in economics from one of the big schools that you would all recognize, which have produced a lot of people who think unlike he does. And additionally, he was the president and CEO of the National Association of Broadcasters. You've all heard of them. And he was kind of instrumental in getting the entire digital switchover of TV accomplished in 2008 and 2009, a more than $1 billion effort, which went off really without a flaw. You did a hell of a job, Dave.
Yeah, thank you.
Dave is kind of an expert on what government does, how to get it to do something else, and what's going to happen if we don't get it to do something else. So I'm going to start off here by kind of going over the big picture. Dave, everybody here has listened to my shows and they've listened to other shows, so they know that the USA is a Titanic heading for the iceberg. Unlike the Titanic, we know the iceberg is there. So tell me, in your opinion, what happens if we don't decrease the size of government, we don't get government spending under control, we don't make government accountable, and we continue on the course we are?
Right. Well, thanks, Reed, first, for having me on the show. It's a great pleasure to be with you and all the people listening. Most importantly, America becomes a second- or third-rate nation and never comes back. We faced some challenges, economic challenges, in the past 200 years, but we always seem to do well because, frankly, we didn't have the competition we do today, whether it's from the Europeans or from China, Southeast Asia, and we can't afford to make mistakes. And I think, unfortunately, our current administration and the Congress are working together to make some horrendous mistakes and to undermine or some might say destroy the American dream.
You know, we're going to talk about those mistakes. I use that word in quotes.
Yeah.
A little bit later in the interview, but just out of curiosity, do you believe that all this is a mistake, or do you believe it's incompetence, or do you believe it's inexperience, or do you believe, at least on the part of some government officials, it's intentional?
Right. I think it's actually a combination of all of the above. I mean, I've been in Washington for 30 years. I think the president and his people are very ideologically driven. They have a hostility to business, to success, to the free enterprise system. I think a lot of them, unfortunately, believe that if people make money, it's always at someone's expense. Rather than the pie growing bigger, the pie is stagnant and different slices are being taken from people who deserve it. I think part of it is incompetence. You know, it's a tough job to be president of the United States, but I think the lack of really President Obama's resume in making tough decisions and being on the right side of a national agenda is playing into this. And I think, thirdly, you know, there's some difficult circumstances out there. He inherited some debt from President Bush. The way Washington has worked in my 30 years in D.C. has always been we can spend more, we can tax more, we can regulate more, but in the global competitive environment we're in, you just can't do that anymore. So I really think it's the combination of all three things that are leading to the current demise of the country if we don't significantly alter our direction.
You know, you were talking about America becoming a second or third rate nation, and that's where we're going to sit forever if that's where we go. Is that kind of, in your opinion, a social justice on a sovereign nation level?
I think it could be. You know, I think there are some in Washington who look across the Atlantic and say, wow, all those European socialist countries really provide good health care. Everyone is, you know,
they provide great health care. If you're in Britain, you wait between 12 and 18 months for a decision.
The decision
is usually no, you die or you suffer.
If
the decision is yes, you wait another year for a doctor in the parts.
That's right. No, that's exactly right. And I think that's, you know, when I was working years ago for the National Federation of Independent Business, which represents small businesses in America, we had this fight over health care mandates, all sorts of things that were coming out of Washington under that George H. Bush, that presidency. But my point is they're looking across the Atlantic going, wow, wouldn't this be great because we're so much smarter than the average American. and I think, the greatness of our system is that we allow for innovation and upward mobility. In my case, my father never went to college. I am the son of a postman. I now have a PhD in economics. I look at my four young children and go, I want a world, I want a country where they have a chance to do better than me.
Amen.
Not where the government's going to take care of them.
Yes, well, the government can't take care of them.
In fact,
the government can't take care of itself.
That's right.
From what we're seeing up there.
Yeah.
You know, let's talk about, we've talked kind of the very big picture, and I think
right.
we're all agreed that there's forces at work, and it's a combination. I happen to believe it's more intentional than incompetent. In fact, I'll go one step further. I would say it's a brilliantly orchestrated plan that's been developing for decades. And, you know, it's barbarians at the gate. And the American people have just in the last several years taken off that veil of day-to-day living and self-indulgence. And I don't say that nastily. I mean, you know, we all live our lives.
Right.
And they have realized that there is a wreck coming.
That's right. I do think, Reed, part of it is that government was never as activist and as big as it is today at the federal, state, and local level. And, you know, the founding fathers, I think, envisioned a government that was always kind of the last institution to look to keep us, you know, keep us safe, protect us, make sure we have roads. But I think, unfortunately, history has shown that now the first reaction a lot of people have, the media has, is always, well, the government should do something.
Exactly.
And that then feeds on, and if I can make one point with your listeners, it's that power is corrupting, and when people, no matter how good they are, come to Washington, if every day somebody's telling you how brilliant you are, how successful you are, how wonderful you are, how giving you are, but it's with other people's money, it changes you.
That's right. OPM, other people's money.
That's exactly right.
That's really kind of the root of the evil, because it's using other people's money, i.e. our money.
That's right.
To increase their power, solidify their power in terms of literally buying votes. That continues this whole conundrum, you know, this whole full circle that just keeps getting bigger and bigger and faster and faster. And I think, tell me if you think I'm wrong, I think that the incredible mishmash of spaghetti at the wall. I mean, there's underhanded things going on with gun control. There's a subterfuge now going on with amnesty through executive order for illegals, which we're going to be talking about in coming weeks. You know, there's all these little expenditures that we find that have been hidden, which we're going to talk about with you. You have a great plan for stopping that, such as loaning Brazil $2 billion to drill oil to sell to China so George Soros can make a profit while we don't drill here.
Right, the level of 10,000 feet under the ocean.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, basically it's the same drilling, which everybody says is too dangerous in the Gulf.
Right.
Okay. And then, of course, the environmentalists, you know, are in there, let's say, trying to shut down the tar sands in Canada, who gives us 40% of our energy supply, far safer than OPEC, and at least we're keeping the money within North America.
Yeah.
And that money flows back across our borders. And what do they think? Do they think that that pipeline, which they're trying to block that comes into the United States, do they really think the Chinese are going to stop construction of the pipeline, which is going to Vancouver right now?
Yeah.
In other words, it's going to be drilled anyway. Do we want the oil, or do we want China to have the oil?
Right.
It goes back to the whole sovereign, you know, social justice.
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of it, yeah, I think to your point, a lot of it's driven by a hostile attitude towards success and towards free enterprise and, frankly, a suspicion of American values.
And a fawning attitude toward lowering everybody, whether you're a sovereign nature, a nation, or an individual, to that modicum of mediocrity, which is the middle.
That's exactly right.
Yes.
Exactly.
Which, by the way, if they can achieve it, what does it do? It ties right back into what you said. It increases their power.
That's right. Well, yep. Long term, though, and I think Friedrich Hayek and a lot of the great economists have said this, you can't run a nation with mediocrity.
No.
You can't run a nation with a controlled state. So eventually, you know, we'll wither at the vine and our wealth will dissipate. Most people are unaware that at the turn of the 20th century, the seventh richest country in the world was Argentina.
Now that's a great example.
And you know, it was basically government that destroyed the economy and the wealth of the country. And, you know, you don't even really think about Argentina these days as being an important power in the world.
No, Argentina, basically, you know, the last great hurrah of Argentina, and it was hardly a hurrah, was the Falkland Islands.
That's right.
And shortly after that, the policies that we see in place now at an accelerating pace – basically made it crash the Argentinian currency.
That's right.
I mean, the whole country turned upside down.
Yeah.
And that is a great example of what will happen to the United States.
Yeah.
If in fact, we continue our current course.
That's right. No matter what politicians do, you can't deceive the market. And the market's going to ultimately judge the value of the currency, the value of all of our assets. And, you know, if we continue to pursue bad economic policies, it's going to have horrendous consequences, not only on our generation, but I think on future generations, because it's going to limit their opportunity.
And it's not just, you know, it's not just economic policies, it's regulatory policies, because the other thing that the market will absolutely understand, it's already understanding it, that's one of the reasons we're seeing what we're seeing, is that the ability of the country to turn itself around and pull itself out of the hole is contingent upon the wherewithal, the talent,
right,
the risk-taking of the individual.
Yep.
And if they see that individual spirit, that individual entrepreneurship and that ability to rise up as America has many times in the past, if they see that suffocated, then, you know, then we truly are in that second, third world country mode and stuck there forever.
That's right. As we speak, there are 4,257 new regulatory actions by this administration, of which 219 of them will have an economic impact of $100 million or more a year.
Absolutely. And there were 609 in July alone.
Yep. It's just amazing. I mean, it's almost a Orwellian doublespeak of, well, we're going to stop bad regulation, but we're going to push, you know, all sorts of regulation. And that just creates more uncertainty. There's $1.3 trillion in cash being held by America's largest 1,000 corporations. And the reason why I think they're keeping it in cash is because there's so much uncertainty with the direction of the country and what the administration and what the Congress is doing, what Washington is doing, that people are saying, you know what, before we start building more factories, let's wait and see.
Absolutely. Well, you know, in a couple of weeks I have a show on Obama's czars and how they tie into everybody's daily life. But I think one of the most dangerous people in the United States right now is Cass Sunstein, the regulatory czar. It's his off, and he's brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, know your enemy.
Right. That's right.
But his office is the office that grinds out these regulations for all these agencies, which are throwing a wet blanket over individual freedom and economic stability, including the EPA, which is absolutely running amok right now.
That's true.
Well, let me ask a question, Dave.
Yeah.
Exactly what could what could Joe and Billy Joe, you know, they're making $100,000 a year. They're both working their butts off. Hopefully, they both have jobs. Maybe one of them's out of a job. You know, they have two kids. They have their house, which they're struggling to hold on to. If this ship does not get turned from the iceberg, give us three bullet points of what they could expect.
Virtually no economic growth, which makes it more difficult for them to get that job. In inflation at some point, the Federal Reserve, through its quantitative easing policy, has dramatically increased the money supply, and we know that when paper money increases, the value of the dollar falls. And I think a malaise in the culture. I mean, I want to be positive in just a second, but I think one thing we need to be worried about is despite the fact that there's this dark cloud over Washington, D.C., and it's trying to figure out how to get across the country, Americans and America is very resilient. And I think by waking up and getting involved and basically taking control of our future, we can stop a lot of this bad stuff from occurring.
Well, I happen to agree with you 100%. I will tell you from my personal standpoint, you know, I've completely revamped the way I do business and my outlook on business over the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And that revamping continues, you know, at an accelerating pace.
Yeah.
And it's a scary thing. So if uncertainty is affecting a small fish like me, then we can only imagine how it's affecting a trillion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar corporation that has to answer to shareholders, et cetera.
That's right. One good consequence of all of the kind of the economic gloom that's occurring currently in the country is I do think people are waking up to getting more engaged and saying, no, we don't need to have more spending. We need to have more accountability. We need to get our ship straight, you know, before we hit the cliff. So the bad thing is we're heading towards the cliff. The good thing is I think a lot of people, particularly business people, are wanting to get more engaged because they want to have a country that they're proud of, that they can live in, that has lots of opportunity and hope for people.
I have often said, both in private conversations and on the air, that the only silver lining to Obama's administration and the havoc he has wrought along with his minions is the fact that it woke many people up, and people are waking up every day, because the alternative, I think, would have been death by a thousand paper cuts.
That's right.
And it might have been too late. This guy was kind of the slap in the face that we needed to go, whoa, what's been happening here?
Yeah. I do think I think that, you know, the president made a big – politically, he made a huge mistake. They calculated that the length of recessions are about 18 months, and he figured when he got into office, I'm going to push Obamacare through. By then, the economy will bounce back and no one will care. And Obamacare, of course, added all sorts of additional costs and burdens on the health sector. The economy didn't come back, and now we're in kind of this stagnant world of high unemployment – no economic growth, potential inflation.
Not potential.
Skyrocketing.
Looming inflation.
That's exactly it. Looming inflation. And they don't know what to do about it.
They're
ideological, so they go, well, we just need to spend more money, which is precisely the wrong solution.
Yeah, the looming inflation actually is a reality. I mean, commodities, three or four shows ago, I gave folks a bunch of statistics. But commodities from copper to cotton to sugar, I mean, this is everyday stuff, have gone up 35 to 165% in 2 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just unbelievable when you think about it. And real wages have declined by 0.2 to 0.5%, depending upon which part of the country you're in. In some really blighted areas, they're down 5 to 10%.
Yeah.
So that's a diabolical combination. So,
one of the things I was going to say, Reed, one of the things that it woke me up to, I mean, I've been here for 30 years in Washington. I consider myself to be a strong enthusiast for the market, free enterprise, you know, actively defend and proactively go, you know, support small business people. One of the things that this woke me up to is we need to have a paradigm shift. Part of it was the Tea Party getting people engaged and saying enough is enough. But I think, you know, in my 30 years in D.C., it's hard to go after spending. As soon as we say we're going to cut spending, somebody says, you know, you're throwing old people into the street or you're going to shut the Washington Monument down. So for me, I had kind of this moment where I said to myself, we need to change the paradigm.
And you're the CEO right now of TransparaGov.
That's right. That's right.
So tell the folks, because I'll tell you what you have planned there and what you're working on is fascinating. And it is a true solution at a macro level, which, of
course,
starts sifting down and helping everybody individually.
That's exactly right. So the theory of – and if anyone's interested in additional information, they can go to our website, which is www.transparagov.com, or they can email me at drehr, R-E-H-R, at davidrehr.com. The theory behind TransparaGov is the following. In 2002, after Enron and WorldCom, Congress passed the Sarbanes-Oxley Law, which provided for financial accountability and financial transparency for large publicly held corporations. And about, I don't know, a year or so ago, maybe a little less than that, I was on the phone with a former congressman from Minnesota who was a great friend of the taxpayers, a guy named Gil Gutnick, and I said to him on the phone, why don't we expect more from our government? Why don't we hold our government in terms of accountability and transparency to the same standard that we're holding these publicly traded companies? And that's how we came up with this idea of developing a platform and tools and a transparency portal so eventually people will be able to, in real time, see how their money's being spent.
Take a moment, Dave, because not all the listeners are going to be familiar with exactly the hoops a public company has to go through to kind of open its books.
Right.
Just give us a couple of bullet points.
Yeah. You need to change your auditing firms every couple years. You need to tie individual financial accounts to people within the company, so you can't change the books. And once they're locked in, they're locked in. You need to provide for this transparency of your financial information, so you can't say, well, we're $1 million of cash in the bank when you're really $1 million in debt.
And you have to immediately tell people if there's any material adverse circumstances that affect the company.
That's exactly right.
And
that's
you
exactly
have to
right.
let people know literally almost on a daily basis, but absolutely on a quarterly basis, what your earnings are in the case of the government, you know, what your deficits are.
That's right. That's exactly right. Now, if you take this business law principle and you apply it in our case to government, right, we most people don't know that most states only reconcile their books once a year, and they're forced to by the federal government. You got to reconcile once a year. Most of them don't do more than that.
Well, they're forced to usually by their constitutions, right?
That's right. That's right. But think about running a business where you don't have to reconcile your books on a monthly basis. You don't know where you are, how much you're spending, how much you have left, how much revenue have you coming in. Most people don't work in real-time data. I mean, just a couple weeks ago at the federal level, we announced that Medicare was having a problem, and that was based on data from 2 years ago.
Yes.
And given the technological world that we live in today, there's really no reason why we shouldn't have real-time current information so we can make better decisions.
Well, tell us a little bit about the inroads you've made with your system and what that system, if applied to government, would do, you know, in terms of the software that you're developing.
Right. So the platform basically ensures that every transaction at the state level has an accountability feature which ensures that someone is responsible for it. No longer is the money just, quote, federal or state funding. No longer is, you know, we don't know who to point the responsibility to, whether we're in the legislature or whether we're private citizens. And I think the discipline within the government is going to dramatically increase because people are going to know that other people, that they're being held accountable.
Well, you know, it's a great idea. Now, you know, going back to our original premise at the beginning of the interview that, you know, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely, and all these guys, virtually all these guys, are power hungry. What kind of response have you had from various states or governments or whatever, and how would you parlay that, let's assume you get a toehold in some states and it's working, into the federal bureaucracy?
Right. Those are good questions. First off, everybody on the left and the right loves the idea of transparency. because they, you know, people on the left of center, people are concerned about.
I'm not sure I agree with
no,
you.
No, no, no.
That.
You, but they're concerned about, you know, how much are we spending in the military? You know, it's, you know, people on the right are concerned about how much we're spending on programs. So it's almost been universal that people want more transparency. I mean, we're in an environment in the world today where we almost have instantaneous transparency in every other aspect of our lives. Some would say maybe too much, but we have it. We should apply it to government, number one. Number two, I think that we're going to find some governors and some state treasurers and some state elected officials who are going to say, you know what, we're the stewards of taxpayers' money, and it's important for them to know where their money's being spent.
That's right. I think every employee at any level of government, local, county, municipal, state, and federal, is a fiduciary. If, number one, they're an employee of the people who pay taxes.
That's exactly right.
And number two, they are a fiduciary of those people's money.
That's right.
That goes back to that OPM concept,
that's
other
right.
people's money.
That's right. And I think if we bring some accountability, I think it will actually enhance their daily lives as employees of the state.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
I mean,
so they have an incentive. Or if their political boss is saying, well, move this money around or change it from this account, our system will not allow that to occur without some sort of communication. So auditors could look at it and go, well, was this approved? Was this not approved? But the long and the short of it is I think state employees, state local employees, hopefully the federal government will get to at some point, will feel embraced by this and go, you know what? I do a good job. I'm working hard. This will buttress my position in the community.
Exactly. I think it's a terrific concept. Now, have you, and you don't need to tell me which states or which governments, but have you had a warm response, at least on some levels?
We have. Interestingly enough, we've had people in about four or five states say, that's a really good idea. We'd like to talk with you more about it. And I think as we roll this out, you know, the beauty of this idea is that once we get one or two or three states or counties or cities to adapt it, people are going to, particularly in the media, are going to aggressively push its adoption all across the country. Because who can't be for accountability and transparency?
Well, I agree 100%. Well, what do you mean who can't be? Those who want to hide the ball, throw a bunch of spaghetti at the wall to confuse, obfuscate, or as I say, hold the glittering quarter in the right hand while the left hand does something else. Those are the folks who don't want transparency, despite their lip service to the contrary.
Well, that's right. But if you're in, let's take the state of Minnesota, and you're the governor of Wisconsin, and a reporter says, Governor, they have transparency and accountability in Minnesota. Are we going to have it here?
Yeah.
You can't really say no.
Exactly. It's kind of like the balanced budget amendment.
That's
right. I mean,
that's
how
right.
do you say I'm against a balanced budget?
That's exactly right. We're hoping that once we get it into one or two or three states, it will be like a wildfire across the country. Eventually, you know, our greatest dreams would be to have the system working in Washington, D.C. We have $81 billion lost in Medicare fraud every year. But no one can seem to find it.
You know, from your lips to the founder's ears.
Yeah, and I think the reason why I'm so excited about this is because I think it changes the paradigm. One other point is in our company we have a transparency portal that would allow individual citizens of states to develop their own kind of dashboard of what they're most interested in and get real-time information about it.
Boy, that's terrific. So bottom line is Joe, Billy Joe, Sam, whatever, let's say they had a pet peeve or a number of pet peeves. Let's say
right.
their pet peeve was welfare.
Right.
Or let's say they're on the left side of thing and their pet peeve is military expenditures.
Right.
They could actually go into your site, okay, or into the government site
right.
that's using your software, and they could put like Google Alerts. I'll just
right.
use that as an example.
That's right.
And they could see everything that's changing financially within their area of pet peeves and focus.
That's right. And
that's terrific.
If the whole package would be taken by the state or local government or by the federal government, they could drill down to the individual expenses.
You know, that's going to make government folks think twice before they sign a check move money to another account, or even sign executive orders to shift money to foreign banks.
Yep. No, that's right. I mean, I think it's going to, you know, if you think about it, we haven't really expected a lot from our government. You know, I was talking to my chairman, former Congressman Gil Gudnick, yesterday, and he said, you know, David, part of it is we now have people working in government who make more money than private sector counterparts.
Yep.
But yet we're willing to, when we go into a fast food restaurant, we're not willing to stand in line more than 2 minutes. But when we go to the Department of Motor Vehicles, we say to ourselves, I'll probably be here for 2 hours.
Yes.
It shouldn't be that way.
Excellent point. Excellent point. Let me ask a question.
Yeah.
That would handle things on a macro basis.
Right.
Two questions. Number one, what do you think the time frame in getting this system, in this system gaining a toehold, and then hopefully, to use your words, spreading like wildfire? I mean, what's the time frame for that?
Yeah, I think, you know, our projections are to look over about the next year, year and a half, 2 years to get it in a number of states. Once we get it into 7, 8, 10, 12 states, I think then we're going to be off and running. The federal government, you know, being in D.C., can only pray and hope that we could eventually get it in the federal government. That'll be harder because it's so big. You know, you probably would need an act of Congress, and you need a president supporting it, et cetera. But I think, you know, it all starts with the grassroots, and you get it into a few states, and I think people are going to go, you know what, this is the right thing. Taxpayers, you know, we should be good stewards of taxpayers' money. We should be transparent. We should be accountable. And I think it's going to hopefully change the direction of the country.
You know, I kind of like that we're taking a leftist principle, i.e. Van Jones, from the bottom up and applying it to this type of change, which is structural.
That's right. And it's hard. I mean, my point is, you know, for if you're in a corporation, which is under the Sarbanes-Oxley laws, right, you still can sell your shares if you don't like how it's being run. But you can't sell your shares if you're a taxpayer in the state of Wyoming or Minnesota or, in my case, in Virginia. So there should be as high a threshold of transparency and accountability as all these corporations, which, you know, we're concerned about.
You know, you gave me a great example when we were preparing for this interview, and you have a pet peeve back there in Virginia. Why don't you tell the listeners about that?
Well, my peeve, and depending on what state you're in, my peeve in Virginia is in the county and at the state level, I always see these cars, leased cars for the state for employees to drive around and go places. Usually you see them, you know, during the day, and then you often see them at night and on the weekend. And I was thinking, okay, you have to lease the car or buy the car. Then you have to have the car serviced. Then you have to fill the car up with gas. And in talking to one of our developers out on the West Coast, I said, you know, my pet peeve is I'd like to know how much money we're spending on gasoline for all these cars. And the developer said to me, David, you'll be able to do it by county.
Yeah.
In real time. Now imagine if you're now all the employees driving all the cars and you suddenly go, hey, everyone's going to know how much gas we're spending and how much we're driving and where we're going and what we're doing. You're probably going to just sit up a little straighter in the car and go, you know what? I want to be sure that I'm doing the best.
Or maybe the car won't be going to the movie theater on Friday night.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you had a great example with an absolutely eye-popping percentage of state budgets that's being spent on so-called transportation. Give us that for a moment.
Yeah. Well, we downloaded our we did a test on a state in the Midwest where we downloaded 134,000 financial transactions from the state. And the developer called me and goes, David, how much do you think is travel related? And I said, I don't know, 7, 10, 12, 14%. He said 38%, not of the amount, but of the number of transactions are travel related. And this is a state where I'm sure they're laying off teachers and not building roads. And so my immediate response was, if the citizens of that state had the wherewithal to know what that was, if there was transparency, he said to me, it would go down.
Absolutely.
I totally agreed. You know, so I think we need to think about how can we be innovative in a paradigm shift to do the right thing, number one, be great stewards of the taxpayers' dollars because they provide the revenue to government to work, to do all the things that we want it to do. And secondly, to help the people inside government develop a better culture so they know, hey, there is accountability, there is transparency. I have to do the right thing all the time. That's required in business and essentially every other institution we're in.
I think it's absolutely terrific. Let's talk very briefly, you know, that's a macro picture.
Right.
Now, what can each listener do today? I keep exhorting folks, number one, don't pick up your phone and call your congressman. Pick up your phone and call 10 other people and have them call 10 other people, and then all of you call your congressman, your representative, your senator,
that's
the White House.
That's right.
Tell us what, you know, you've been a Washington insider with lots of influence for decades.
Yeah.
What are your recommendations?
I say this very, you know, some of the listeners would be like, oh, my God. But my job was to get members of Congress to do the right thing. And whatever I defined the right thing to be,
yes.
Both in, you know, in small business and then in the beer industry and then in the broadcast business. But you would be surprised how much you can impact Washington with relatively few people. And let me just give you examples of things people can do. Number one, get people to call the office. But just don't call the office. The number to Washington, you can get any member of Congress by calling 202-225-3121 and ask for your congressman.
That's 202-225-3121.
That's right. And you just say, you know, Senator Brasso and they'll from Wyoming, and they'll put you through to his office. But don't just talk to the receptionist. Their job is to basically say, thank you for calling. We'll put you on the list. Have a nice day. Say then, who is the person handling spending in the office? I would like to speak with them. And they'll put you through to the legislative person who's handling spending or deficits or quantitative easing, whatever issue, health care, Obamacare, whatever you care about, and talk with them and be articulate, non-threatening, but emphasize to them how you're very concerned about this.
Great suggestion. Give us some more.
Number two, go to the district office. Every member of Congress, every senator has a district office. They usually have a big sign in front of it. It's usually on a major thoroughfare. It's designed to remind people that they're actually working for them in Washington, D.C. No one shows up at these district offices other than people who are having a problem with their Social Security, with their Medicare, maybe they have a veterans benefit. But, you know, most people are there to ask things. Show up and meet the person and say, I'm here because I'm concerned about this. Bring 10 or 15 of your friends with you. You could do it during the lunch hour. You can do it after work. People will be just shocked. This is what will happen. You bring 15 people. You all talk to the person who's in the district office. They immediately call Washington and say, there are a lot of people who are concerned about this. And it sets off like, you know, the flares are going up in the air.
Terrific.
Another idea is publicly thank a member of Congress when they stand strong to reduce spending.
Letter to the editor.
Letter to the editor.
Yep.
Go on a radio show. You know, if you're in a local community and there's a talk radio show, call in and say, you know what, I am here to thank Senator Brasso because he is holding the line against spending increases and is absolutely the right thing to do.
Great suggestion.
Another suggestion is members of Congress have town hall meetings and office hours for constituents. Hardly anybody goes. I worked for a member from southwestern Minnesota, rural area of the state, and hardly anybody showed up for these things. You get five or six people, they're all sitting there, you're all talking about the same thing, you have FaceTime with the member of Congress, usually the key staff person is with them, they'll get the message. Another way to get involved, and I mean this very sincerely and frankly, is help people who believe what you believe. If they're running for office, you know, if there's somebody in office that you don't like, work to defeat them. If there's somebody that you do like, put up a sign. You know, put a bumper sticker on your car. Talk to your friends about that person because, you know, there's now we've seen, you know, George Soros and a lot of these groups are using money to defeat members of Congress who are standing strong for small business and free enterprise and limited government. And we need to get everybody involved in individual communities to basically support that person, to let them know that there are people out there who believe what they believe and who support what they're doing.
And I would interject, you know, that Soros and his many financial tentacles which I believe, once again, all flow back to power and greed, and some ideology. But Soros buys his support. Okay, that is an advantage, I think, that our side has. Our side is motivated by a love of country, motivated by individual attitude, and motivated by firmly held belief. I don't think that there are people, there are exceptions, there are people on the other side that feel just as strongly in their ideology, but I think that a large portion of the left is bought.
Yeah. I think that's part of it. I mean, I do think a lot of them are driven by their ideology. They just see the world very differently than we do, for whatever reason. Sometimes it might be bitterness. Sometimes, you know, they think, well, I'm so smart. Why am I not successful? You know, well, you got to provide value to other people.
And tell the folks what you think about, you know, sending some financial support, even if it's $5.
Yeah,
I mean,
it
all adds
matter.
Up.
That's right. It doesn't matter. So if you're running for Congress in pretty much any congressional district in the country, I think it was in 2010, it costs about $1.6 million to run. If you're running for the Senate, it costs about between $7.5 and $10 million. You know, and you're thinking, well, I can only afford $5 or $10, or maybe I could give $100. I always think about this. I mean, I just helped a guy in Montana running for the Senate, Denny Reberg, who's a great friend of small business.
And by the way, he is terrific.
Yeah. And I wrote him a personal check. I'm not from Montana. You know, I live in Virginia. But I thought to myself, if I want a bright future for my kids, I need to make a financial investment in these people to help them do the right thing.
Absolutely. It is kind of like a present to your kids, isn't it?
That's exactly right. That's exactly
yeah.
right. You know, I'm just telling you, as a former congressional staffer who, when I worked on Capitol Hill, part of my job in my off time was to fundraise and to talk to our constituents and meet with our donors, every dollar counts because, you know, if you're running, you got to put up signs and you got to buy television and you got to offset all the negative publicity that you're going to get from the other side. And you need money to do that.
Absolutely. What about inviting an elected official to your business?
That is another great, great idea. You know, in proactively call the district office or call their Washington office and say, you know, when the congresswoman or the congressman's in town, I'd like them to swing by and meet me and my employees. Or meet me, my employees, and I'm going to do a little brown bag lunch and invite 10 people from the Kiwanis or the Chamber of Commerce to meet with the person as well. They will love it.
Great suggestion.
And they will come.
Great suggestion. Give us another one.
I think, you know, if you're really into helping change the country and you like politics and you like campaigns, take a leadership position in a congressional campaign. You know, for Congressman Reberg in Montana, small business people form a small business people's committee for Denny Reberg, or, you know, whatever it is, but just be more engaged than just writing a check or sending a letter. You know, try to help out. Give 1 or 2 hours a week, and you'll be amazed at the difference that can make.
Yeah, it's really an investment in your future and the future of your children's children.
That's exactly right. A lot of these races are going to be very close in 2012. Because we do have this unfortunate kind of polarized, you know, 30-40% of the country is self-described as conservative, 25% self-described as liberal, the rest are independents moving back and forth depending on the issues and the candidates and the personalities and the people. But, you know, basically just saying, you know, rather than watching television, I'm going to take an hour and I'm going to help this person stuffing envelopes or walking door to door or talking to my neighbors. It will make a huge impact. We had in southwestern Minnesota, we had one farmer who made his own sign. And my old boss, like every time we drove down Highway 12, he would just say, God, I love that guy. He made his own sign and put it up for me.
Yeah, terrific.
So you can have a huge impact.
Well, you know, people do need to get motivated. They need to get others motivated and involved. And I got to tell you, I think your macro – I mean, listen, without the micro solution, you're not going to have the people in there who are going to vote to implement your macro decision when it flows up from the states to the federal government, and they have to make a decision on it.
That's right.
So, you know, I wish you the best of luck on what you're doing there at TransparaGov. I think it is absolutely terrific. I can't wait to see it implemented in a few states, and I can't wait to see the groundswell of support, which, you know, kind of forces it down the throat or up another orifice of Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Why don't you give us your why don't you give us your website and your email again, Dave?
Yeah, it's www.transparagov.com is the website, and it's password protected because we have some intellectual property that we're getting patented. But go there, you'll get it approved, it'll come back, the link will come back to you. And more importantly, if you're interested in more information, you can email me at drehr, R-E-H-R, at davidrehr.com.
Well, Dave, it's been terrific. Thank you very much for your time. I'd love to have you back on here in a month or two. We'll see what kind of progress you're making, and we'll see what kind of progress the country is making.
Yep. Well, thanks for having me. Thanks to your listeners for taking their time to hear me out. And, you know, despite the fact that we have a lot of challenges in America, you know, I just think that we live in the greatest country in the world, and if we all work together, we can have a very positive impact on the future.
And I would add that it's our responsibility. This is our time to step up.
That's right.
All right, Dave, thanks.
Thank you.
Bye now.
For more information about Reed and his work, please click on the globe in front of you on the webtalkradio.net page. You can also click on his book, Land for Love and Money, and his new best-selling historical western series, Threads West, an American Saga. Watch for the second volume of the saga, Maps of Fate, coming soon. And, of course, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archives to catch up. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed L. Rosenthal on the Right Side.